Welcome back to Raising Rare. We are in our fifth season talking about the joys, challenges, and surprises of raising children with a rare disease. Our co-hosts, Sanath Ramesh and Brittany Ratke, will keep you updated on their kiddos. And we hope our lineup of guests will give you new insights and hope. My name is Kevin Fryert. Welcome back to Raising Rare. Today we are speaking with Megan Nolan, a rare mom, marketing expert, founder, and now e-publisher. It's safe to say Megan likes to stay busy. Unfortunately, Brittany is not back yet. We wish her strength and all the best. Hopefully she will be back soon. So, Sanath, what's Raghav up to these days?
Today's the first day he slept well after many days, so I'm hoping this is going to be a streak that he can keep up, but healthy.
With sleep, a streak starts with one, so that's good.
Megan, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit more about you and your family?
Yeah, so thank you, Sanath and Kevin. I'm really happy to be here. So we have two little boys. Our first son, Domenico, is 3 years old, and he has FOXG1 syndrome, which is a rare neurodevelopmental disease. And our second little boy is Giorgio. We call him Georgie, and he's a year and a half.
How did you come about knowing Domenico had the FOXG1?
It was a long process, as it is for many parents. We initially saw many developmental delays in his first couple of months, even. He had low eye contact. He wasn't rolling over. He was crying for 6 to 7 hours at a time, amongst other issues. He had feeding issues. He had digestive issues. And when we took him to the pediatrician, we were sort of asked to follow a wait-and-see approach. We were told many kids are developmentally delayed these days. Let's wait it out. Maybe he'll improve. But the symptoms kind of just kept piling on, and he wasn't improving, and he wasn't sitting up. He wasn't pushing up off the floor. He wasn't crawling and doing all of the things that he was supposed to do at the expected milestones. So it was a tough time. We ended up kind of carting him to multiple pediatricians, and we got the same response really across everyone, which was, let's take the wait and see approach. One pediatrician had mentioned early intervention, which to me at the time seemed like a lot of hoops to go through when really I was just looking for a diagnosis. I think what I wanted looking back at the time was for someone to say, hey, you need to see a neurologist and your kid needs to get genetically tested. And I think that's kind of what's missing at the pediatrician level right now. Doctors aren't referring people to neurologists fast enough for further evaluation. So with Domenico, we eventually decided to do strabismus surgery, double eye surgery. His eyes were crossing since he was a baby, really not so much in the first month. I think most kids don't begin any sort of eye crossing until the second month, and that was the case with him too. Many kids have eye crossing early in life. They outgrow it usually around the 6 month. Domenico wasn't outgrowing it. So we studied, we researched strabismus, and we learned that many kids with strabismus may have depth perception problems and they may have double vision. So since we didn't really have any other answers, we didn't know what was going on with him. We thought, well, maybe it's this depth perception problem and it's this potential double vision that's giving him trouble with pushing off the floor and you know, rolling over and sitting up. So we decided to go ahead and move forward with strabismus surgery. And we found this great eye doctor at CHOP in Philly, and we moved forward with it. And 2 days after surgery, his procedures began. CHOP has a wonderful pediatric neurology department, and we were immediately pushed to a great neurologist in that department who right away suspected a neurological disease. So he gave us a lesson really in genetic testing and what a non-inherited genetic disease is. And of course, we decided to move forward with it. And then 6 weeks later, he was diagnosed with FOXG1 syndrome.
And how old was he when he was diagnosed?
He was 16 months. So we went through 16 months of really just trial and error, I guess, of trying to figure things out.
Oh, that's painful. And having serendipitously landed on a good neurology clinic is also kind of painful because, you know, you could have gone another 16 months without actually talking to a neurologist too. And the system really failed you there.
So before we went for the strabismus surgery, we went and saw a neurologist actually, because we were thinking maybe we needed an MRI. We still didn't know anything about non-inherited genetic diseases. No one had mentioned genetic disorders to us or genetic testing to us. So it was still all very foreign. So for us, we were thinking maybe he suffered oxygen loss at birth and maybe this is what's happening. Maybe usually HIE, which is oxygen loss at birth, usually it's identified at birth. Doctors usually see the signs, but there is a slight chance that you can have delayed symptoms. And we thought maybe that was it. So we did see a neurologist and we told them, you know, our options right now are an MRI or strabismus surgery to kind of seek an opinion. And he kind of said, whichever one you'd like, you can do the MRI first or you can do the strabismus surgery. But again, he didn't mention genetic testing. I just sort of wish that option was there. I wish someone had mentioned genetic testing to us earlier because it would have saved us a lot of stress and a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah, I can imagine. We had a similar experience myself too. But fast forward today, how is he doing?
Well, today specifically, he's not doing so well. He's sick. I don't really know what's wrong with him. Sometimes he has these vomiting episodes where he doesn't hold down food very well or medicine. He has a feeding tube, so we give him his medicine with water through the feeding tube, and he won't hold that down either right now, which happens sometimes. And it's just different than when you have a typical kid. When you have a typical kid, they say, "Mommy, my tummy hurts," and you know that they probably have a stomach bug because their symptoms coupled with what they're telling you sounds like a stomach bug. And with Domenico, he's nonverbal, right? He's nonverbal and non-ambulatory. He has no purposeful movements of his hands. So he can't point at his tummy even and tell me it's a stomach thing. So you just kind of have to figure out how to diagnose him yourself, or you can take him to the hospital. So with a kid like Domenico, you can't really call your pediatrician because pediatricians aren't equipped. They're not trained to handle these specific children. So when your kid is very sick, your only option really is to go to the hospital. So the last time he was sick like this, we went to the hospital because what can happen when your kid is sick, they can progress very quickly to having a pneumonia. And for kids with neurodevelopmental diseases, including kids with FOXG1, a pneumonia can progress to death. So many kids do die from the complications that happen with a pneumonia. In fact, 30% of kids die before age of 5. And this is sometimes due to complications with a pneumonia, and sometimes they're dying overnight for an unknown cause, likely related to breathing issues, or sometimes they're dying overnight due to a seizure. So there's just like a lot of fear, I think, that we as parents live in with regards to keeping our kid alive. Every new parent has that idea of like, oh my God, I was gifted this beautiful little being and I have to keep them alive. But they're not actually facing death the way we're facing death. We're actually facing death. It's a completely different way, really, to live. And so you end up taking on immense amounts of responsibility because you fear what might happen if you're giving your child to someone else to care for them, right? So we have someone who helps here in my house, but I don't work outside the home for this reason. I need to be near him in case something goes wrong. Today, if he's vomiting, I need to run over to make sure that he's okay. And so on and so forth. It's just different. It's a different life.
I completely understand, especially the part where you said he cannot point his finger at the belly and say it's hurting. that's exactly what my son is. And we're just in the recovery phase of a stomach bug, or what we think is a stomach bug. And I have no clue if it is really a stomach bug or something else going on. But my son would cry chronically through the day a lot, through like 3 or 5 days. And it's been happening almost first week of every month now since November. And I don't know why.
Can you remind me how old he is? Why.
He's five.
And which is his disease?
He has a mutation in a gene called GPX4. He's one of 10 kids in the world with this condition. So very few parallels to draw from. And so we've always, like, just like you, it's been trial and error, right? We think it is one problem. We deal with it. We see if it helps and goes away. If not, we kind of do have another hypothesis and run another experiment and see if that works out. So it's been quite a challenge, and I can definitely appreciate what you're going through.
So your son must have difficulty sleeping in the same way that Domenico does. Is his disease also neurodevelopmental?
Pretty much. I mean, like the pneumonia that you said, he just had pneumonia 2 weeks ago.
And you went to the hospital?
Yeah, we did. We came back home, fortunately.
It's interesting, as you were telling your story, Megan, I could see in Sana's eyes that, this is very familiar. This is exactly what we've talked about several times on it, podcast. So one of the things you said, actually two things mushed together, pediatricians aren't equipped to do this. So you go to a hospital. Are you finding the hospitals are equipped, and or have you found a hospital where people know you now and say, oh, here comes Domenico. Here's the things we need to go through to rule out what might be bothering him.
Yeah, so you hit it really perfectly. Initially, when we took him to hospitals, we were living in different places. We were living in London, then we were living at my parents' house, and then we were in New York. We were at my parents' house temporarily because we were in town from London for the surgery. So we were at a number of different hospitals. And most of the time when we took him to a hospital with a seizure or with a severe symptom, they really didn't know what was going on. I had attendings who didn't recognize certain seizures as being seizures, for example, or attendings who didn't recognize acid reflux as acid reflux, because these symptoms just present so differently in kids with neurodevelopmental diseases than they do in typical kids. Acid reflux, for example, can present like a seizure. The kid can be screaming at the top of their lungs as though they're having a seizure when it's really just acid reflux. And emergency staff aren't always trained to recognize symptoms in that way, right? So I think it is crucial for you to stabilize your life, which is what we finally did. Find your team, your care team, and like you said, have them become familiar with your child. So for us, the majority of our care team members, if you will, our practitioners are at NYU here in New York. So when we go to the emergency room at NYU, they have his history. They know who he is. It doesn't really matter who sees him in the emergency room because he's kind of already in the system. So they kind of know what they're walking into in a way. And they also know who they need to call if they need to get a second opinion, because other people at the hospital would have seen my child. There would be notes in the system about my child. So they're more equipped to problem solve because there's history of him inside the hospital. Whereas if you go to a new hospital, there's no history. They're kind of doing the best they can to diagnose your kid. It's very, very different when they have all of the previous history. It makes things much easier for the emergency room staff. So that is also something I wish you knew when you walked into having a child with severe complex needs. I wish someone would tell you, hey, by the way, you need to develop a care team right away. You need to make sure you're always going to the same hospital so everyone inside it knows who you are and can help you. And it might sound obvious, but establishing a care team in particular isn't really that obvious, because in the beginning, why do I need a pulmonologist? Why do I need a GI doctor? Like, I don't know that I need these people until something happens and all of a sudden I need these people. Whereas had I known from the beginning, you should probably go and get one of each of these doctors because these are the typical symptoms your kid might have, then I would have sort of what's called establishing care. I would have established care with each of my practitioners so that when the issue did come up, I knew who to call, right? Because the GI doctor would have told me, hey, these are the typical symptoms that I cover. If you're experiencing anything like this, come see me. And they are that kind and that happy to have these first sort of intro meetings with you. You just don't know that you need them.
Yeah. And it's, you said, if you said, if you knew from the beginning, but when is the beginning? When do you go and get this download? Because unfortunately, with rare kids, it's not the same as kids who don't have anything other than, you know, the typical colds and bumps and bruises. They don't need a big care team. So no one's saying, oh, it's time to get a care team put together or to establish care, as you called it. You're stepping into the unknown and it just unfolds in front of you. And I think it's interesting. You said you were in London and we've talked many times about how there's a need to move to find the care you need or to find the experts you need or the situation. So what was that move? Why did you make that move? And how did that shift things for you?
We moved primarily for Domenico's healthcare. London has wonderful doctors, absolutely, but getting in to see them is complicated. Everything runs under the national health system, which, you know, Americans, I think, are aware that you have free healthcare in England. Most people think we should have free healthcare too. The problem with free healthcare is that you don't always control your healthcare. In America, you can pick up the phone, someone's going to answer it, first of all, someone's going to answer the phone, and you can pick a time and date that works for you and your family to see a doctor. It doesn't work like that in England. In England, you have to first go online to your pediatrician's website, request an appointment, you get a phone call from someone asking details about the appointment. Then if they decide that the appointment is worthwhile, then they schedule the appointment for you. If you need to see a specialist, you call a different number. So say I need a neurologist, you call a different number and you get a letter in the mail that tells you when your appointment is. And your appointment may be 6 months out, 8 months out at times, and you don't get to choose your appointment date or time. And so if that date or time doesn't work for you, you have to call back, make a new appointment, and you go to the back of the line. If they cancel the appointment on you for any reason, you also go to the back of the line. So that happened to us. And that was kind of the last straw for us. We had an appointment that was 6 or 7 months out and we were a week away from it. We got a new letter in the mail saying, I'm sorry, the appointment was canceled. Your new appointment is another 7 months out. So we were just like, okay, here's my kid who has a severe neurological problem, and we don't get to see a doctor for a year. So the thing with private healthcare is that you can pay your way, right, to choosing your doctors, but you don't get to cut the line. And they do that, I think, because it's fair. And I agree with that. It should be fair. So when you pay, it just means that you get to pick which doctor you want to see, and you get to see the same doctor every time. If you're not paying, then you don't get to choose the doctor that you're seeing, and you don't always get to see the same doctor every time. So this means you end up retelling your story over and over. So all of this for me was just so foreign. And the idea that I could never pick up the phone and have someone answer it and make an appointment for me, that everything was snail mail and go on the website. And even when I called the pediatrician, sometimes you'd wait for 2 hours before you even got through. So it was a very, very difficult time when you're sitting there with a kid who has serious issues. You don't know what's wrong with him. And you feel like no one's really listening to you because everyone's telling you to just wait and see. And then even trying to see doctors is like walking through glue in this foreign country with this system that really just should not operate that way. And I really don't mean to be so hard on England, but it's a problem. It is a serious problem and it needs to change. And I feel terrible for all of the families who live in England who have to deal with things the way that I had to deal with things. It's not right.
Wow. I mean, I cannot even imagine living there for a day. Like yesterday, we got a GI doctor's appointment on the 30th of January. And yesterday, my son got sick again. And so I emailed them. I told them, hey, I need to see you again because we are not able to diagnose and solve the problem. And we got an appointment for later today. I mean, these sort of things just are needed for our kids because I cannot predict how things are going to change. And there's no, he gets sick once every 2 years kind of a pattern here. Like he gets sick anytime and he gets really sick really fast. And I need help when I need it, not when your system can decide when it can offer help. So, I mean, I'm glad you guys moved.
Yeah. So in England, you can take your kid to the emergency room when they're really sick. And what I found, so I ended up joining a number of different WhatsApp groups. There's all these like mom and dad parent WhatsApp groups. And what I found is that if your kid has an ear infection or a potential strep throat, whatever it is, something that needs attention right then, such as with your GI issue, your only option actually is to go to the emergency room because you can't actually get in to see the pediatrician right away. So you end up having all of these families just overflowing out of the emergency room because for any ailment, that's your option. So it's not like England is not taking care of people, just to be clear, that you can go to the emergency room if there's an issue. It's just then you have to wait for hours. You know what it's like to be in an emergency room. Your kid has an ear infection. Why do you have to go to the hospital and wait 4 hours to be seen? And then you have to, it's just very, very difficult. It's not like here. Here, worst case scenario, if you're coming from a small town, you have your pediatrician who usually can take you in right away. Worst case scenario, in a big city like Manhattan, if you can't get in that second, you can go to an urgent care and you can get the script that you need for those minor issues for typical kids, right? For our kids, yes, I think if you have your doctors that you trust, they usually can get you in those emergency situations. So it's just a different life. Like, I'm so grateful I live in a country where healthcare works this way. And honestly, I'm so happy I don't live in a free healthcare system. I think I'd have to leave in part to free healthcare.
I work at a health insurance company and we talk a lot about how the system is broken and it doesn't work for a lot of people. Yes, it doesn't work for a lot of people, but for the people that need the most, I think the system, at least for like you and me, Megan, like the system has been doing what it's supposed to do.
You may be one of our listeners who is actively trying to find treatments for your rare kiddo because no one else is. Have you ever felt like just when you thought you understood how to find and develop treatments, there's something new to learn? One more step. Imagine a place you can go to see the big picture and drill down to the details you need today. We at Salem Oaks are building that place. We are calling it the Biopharmaceutical Atlas for Discovery and Development, your self-paced guide to understanding the process of medical research and development. We call it the Atlas for short. Each month, we will deliver at least 30 minutes of bite-sized microlearning content that you can digest when it is convenient for you. We need your help to design the Atlas to meet your needs. So check us out at www.salemoaks.com/atlas.
Sure. When we were diagnosed, there was one person who mentioned that no one's working on FOXG1 research. And when we went home to the hotel, we found multiple organizations working on FOXG1 research. And I kind of always look back to that day. Essentially, 3 months after he was diagnosed, we started the fund to raise money for FOXG1 research. But as we were kind of dreaming up what we were going to put together, I was always looking back on that moment because I was in a situation where I ran businesses before Domenico was born, and I knew I was capable of running a charity, of building a website, of doing all of the things on top of, honestly, zero sleep. I was getting zero sleep. And I still knew I was capable because I had the training, I had the skill set. And I always just kind of thought about, well, what about all of the families who don't have the training, don't have the skill set, and end up not putting together charities? There are obviously lots of families who power through it, they figure it out, and they create a charity anyway. But there's millions of families who don't put it together. And I just felt like it's not fair. I felt like it's not fair that you have millions of children around the world where research is not being done for their disease, millions of parents around the world who wake up every morning without any hope that someone's working on a cure for their kid. And to me, it wasn't fair. So we decided to create the Children's Rare Disorders Fund in hopes that when we find a cure, whether it's us or one of the other organizations working on FOXG1, we can replicate successes on the next rare disease that needs our help, the next rare disease where no one's working on their kid's disease, essentially. And that was really the idea behind it. I think that a little bit of part of me didn't really understand at the time how many millions of dollars you need to cure a disease. However, a lot of that is money that kind of is wasted a little bit because you end up doing a number of projects before you find something that works. So if you end up finding something that does work, then it's easier. It's essentially less money to replicate it than to try five new projects on a different disease. And so this is also what we saw when we were researching the rare disease space. We saw a lot of different charities duplicating efforts. And it really wasn't even by fault of their own. A lot of times the research is hidden because the universities don't want to share the research. And then for research that makes it to the FDA also kind of keeps walls around things. So you don't always know what's going on and what's going through the FDA. So the whole system is very, very complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Sonnet's other company, his other company, his handful of companies, is called Open Treatments. It's an open source research company.
As it should be. Honestly, I wish everyone was open source. But so what we were seeing really was all of these walls. We were seeing the walls between, as you're saying, the companies, universities, and even at the FDA level. And it was just obviously glaringly clear that if foundations owned more rare diseases, you'd save a lot of money, right? You'd save so much money in resources. And we didn't really understand why there weren't more nonprofits who operated across a number of diseases. And the reality is because it's the nonprofits are built by parents. The nonprofits are built by parents of a kid with a disease. And all they can really focus their attention on and their fundraising on is the one disease, because that's hard enough as it is, right? So there isn't like this miracle company in between that's like, I'm going to take on 10 diseases, because there isn't a lot of profit from a business standpoint, right? So you don't have businesses jumping in on this research bandwagon. It ends up just falling on the shoulders of the parents. There are a few different nonprofits that work with biotech companies who have mastered a specific therapy that then take on a few diseases. So it sort of exists in a way. But either way, what we were hoping was that we can take on more diseases to sort of help the larger community and save money while doing it, you know?
So more specifically, like, your organization is called Children's Rare Disorders Fund. And when I see fund, I'm imagining your primary purpose is to fund, say, startups, like, you know, do seed funds for startups and so on. But that is not what you're doing, right? So could you explain more specifically, how do you plan on, you know, reducing the silos and helping more diseases?
Yeah, so we called ourselves a fund because our primary purpose really is to raise money. Since there were originally other organizations working on FOXG1 research that were doing great research, we didn't feel a need to replicate anything that was already happening. Because again, our whole purpose was not to replicate efforts, right? That's what we want to do with other diseases too. So why would we replicate efforts that are already out there? So initially, the idea was, we just need to raise as much money as we can, and then we're going to grant that money to those projects that we felt were most promising, with hope that one of those come to fruition, work, and then we can sort of take over that lab to replicate their services on the next rare disease, right? That's really what our hope is and our long-term vision for the company. But we have a ways to go.
That's awesome, but that's a big lofty goal. I'm hopeful.
Thank you.
For your success.
So before you even got settled in the US with your move from London to Manhattan, you started another venture. It's called rareparenting.com. Can you tell us about that? What's the story behind it? How's it going? And how can we help?
Thanks, Kevin. Yes. So Rare Parenting is an online magazine built for parents of children with special needs, disabilities, and rare diseases. We're covering all topics across all symptoms and disorders and abilities. So it isn't built only for kids with severe rare disorders like my son. We're also touching on symptoms of autism and ADHD right up to strabismus surgery and severe acid reflux, right? The reason why I created Rare Parenting was because of that diagnostic odyssey, as everyone calls it, that I went through, as well as because of all of the issues that I had identifying his symptoms and finding the right care to treat them. So before Domenico was born, that's what I did. I worked in magazines and marketing and advertising here in New York. When he was born, my career died by choice, as it does for many parents in my situation, when I became his full-time caregiver. It took us until now, really, until about 6 months ago, before we actually found someone that was right to help me on a daily basis. So up until August of last year, I was his 24/7 caregiver. He sleeps with me at night. He requires care overnight. So in going through this kind of tough time where you're not getting any sleep, you're doing all this caregiving, and then you also don't know how to deal with all of the symptoms, my first and my husband's first reaction usually is to immediately go to the phone, find a really quick answer on the internet to potentially help you figure out what's going on. And time again, we weren't able to find any information. And then similarly, as I mentioned with our issues with diagnosing him at the pediatrician level, and I touched on this earlier when you asked about, you know, going to a pediatrician now, when we have a severe symptom, the pediatrician doesn't really always know what it is because they don't recognize the symptoms. Again, they're not classically trained in that way. So we would be looking on the internet. We wouldn't find answers. Our pediatrician wouldn't be sure. Our next line of defense would be our neurologist. But a neurologist isn't going to be able to recognize symptoms of GI issues or even know that it's a symptom of a GI issue, right? So they wouldn't really know who to refer us to either. And we kept getting answers from the parents, from other FOXG1 parents. And I'm so grateful that I have them to tell me, oh yes, that's definitely acid reflux. Here are the three drugs you should consider trying. I feel so badly for you, Sanath, that you guys only have 4 known patients in the world because you don't have my parent group to help you. Right. And so this, your situation is one of the very reasons why Rare Parenting began. We felt that information needs to be online. Parents shouldn't have to go to their pediatrician, go to their neurologist, and then go to other moms to get an answer. There should be doctor-backed advice online. And what about the families who have 4 known patients like Sanath? Where's their parent group? Where are they going? What about the kids who are still undiagnosed? What about all of the kids? And not the ones like us who it just took them a while to get diagnosed. What about the ones who went through multiple rounds of genetic testing and they still don't have answers? Where are they going? Where's their parent group when their kid has a symptom? Who's helping them? And that is essentially why I was compelled to start this magazine. It needed to be done, and it needed to be done with the doctor backing. It's similar to like a parents or a baby center, but for the special needs community. So it's strictly advice led, right? You are not going to find my story on there or Domenico's story on there. You won't find parents talking about their kids, you know, issues and their journeys. All of these first person stories you can find across many different websites, right? So again, we weren't looking to replicate content that's already out there. We were looking to create content that's not out there. And what's not out there is symptom management, diagnostic management, and sometimes personal issue management too, like finances. What are special needs trusts? I didn't even know about special needs trusts until not that long ago, right? And what about your own personal relationships, right? How to manage arguments with your husband, or how to fight fairly, or how to talk to your family about your kids, your kid's disease, or how to talk to your other kids about their brother or sister's disease. Just all of these things that we face. And many of these ideas, many of these types of contents you can find on various blogger websites who talk about their own experiences, which is wonderful. And they serve a purpose because people do want to hear from directly from people going through it. But there also should be a home that has the approach of doing it in a doctor-backed way. So all of our articles are written by professional writers who come from places like the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, Fortune, Forbes, and Parents and Baby Center, and that's where our editors are from too. And they're journalists. So each topic they research heavily, they interview doctors and parents about it, and then they write it up. And then it goes through an editorial review, and then it also goes through our medical board.
This is beautiful. I was talking to a parent recently, an acquaintance, and they were talking about how much their Facebook group has been their biggest source of support. They haven't found anywhere else where that level of support was available. And what you're building right now is certainly going to be hugely valuable for folks that don't have the Facebook group. And even for the folks that do have the Facebook group, to weed through the noise. Part of the reasons why, I mean, I joined a whole bunch of these groups after my son was diagnosed, but I stopped following them because my son's playbook wasn't in there. He was so unique, so different, so rare that I had to, you know, go to the special needs or GTube feeding group to talk about GTube. I had to go to a special needs group to talk about, you know, special needs finances, and it was just not sustainable. And I would get a lot of imperfect information that just didn't make sense, right? And someone would say, "Yeah, my son has cerebral palsy, and your son's diagnosis looks like cerebral palsy." So I'd even get like online diagnosis from people, right? And that weren't qualified to do that. So I felt like I had a huge gap. So I stopped following any of these and started building my own playbook. And having a rigorous process with qualified people writing and reviewing and publishing this information and knowing what the implications of this information are and publishing them is going to be really, really useful. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I think that Sonnet just talked about his experience. What I was thinking is people can get pulled into those groups, but those are people who are really deep into this and they're talking at a different level. And what you're providing is something where you're going to give them enough of the information across the board, because I've looked at your site and you're going across the board, enough of these that they get good information, like you said, vetted, doctor-backed information on many topics, because it's hitting people in your situation from all over the place. These things just keep popping up, and you can't go into a group that's like focused on special needs trusts and deal with all the other things that are flowing by in your life. So,
yeah, what I'm hoping is that I'm hoping people become regular readers and read as much of the content as possible, so that when they hit a symptom, they would have already read something about it and they would recognize it and say, "Oh, I read an article about this. And so I know I need to go call this type of doctor, make an appointment to help manage this symptom," right? That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that it acts as a preparation tool so that as parents go through things, they feel a little bit more prepared, because the worst thing is getting hit with a symptom and having no idea what to do about it or where to go. Of course, when you're hit with a symptom, you can use the website to, you know, use the search bar to see if you can figure it out and find the article that's relevant to it. But I think that preparation is key. And there's so much content on there that I wish I would have read. Even in diagnosis, there's an article about the signs and symptoms of a neurological disease. Had I read that article in Domenico's first months, I would have known he needs genetic testing. I would have understood genetic testing for non-inherited diseases, and I would have signed him up myself. I wouldn't have waited for seizures to come and for a doctor to say, oh, he probably needs genetic testing. It would have saved me so much time, stress, worry, and just, it was an awful period, that period. And it would have just been wiped clean had I read that article. And the same thing with his G-tube. I waited probably too long for us to move forward with getting his G-tube. And it was because I didn't really understand, I think, how important it was for his nutrition and well-being. I saw it more as like an easy way out. Like, it's taking me 4 hours to feed him. Getting in G-tube means I don't have to spend 4 hours feeding him anymore. I almost felt like the G-tube was for me as much as it was for him. And what I wasn't really seeing was that actually it's really important for him because he's also struggling. Like, it's taking 4 hours because the kid's having trouble swallowing. And these were things that I didn't know. I wasn't really aware of all of the issues that were going on with him. And I wasn't really seeing it from that viewpoint. Whereas that article lays all of that out. And had I read it immediately, I would have been like, okay, I don't want him to go through another surgery, but this is what's best for my kid. So let's move forward and do it. And that also would have saved, I think, a lot of frustration for us and for him. So that's my hope. My hope for the site is just to help people get diagnosed more quickly and to help them diagnose and care for their kids and themselves and, you know, their relationships in a better way. We need more help. All of us parents, we need a lot more help. And I hope that people can rely on Rare Parenting to be that help for them.
So we're just about out of time here. What's one key takeaway message you want our listeners to leave with today?
Yeah, I think that I would love people to review Rare Parenting and pass it along to absolutely anyone who is going through a rough moment with their kid. You know, I think when you sometimes see your friends with kids who are having issues and you might not feel comfortable asking them what's going on, send them to Rare Parenting and say, hey, check out this site. There's a lot of great stuff on here. Maybe you'll find something that can help you. And if we can just help handfuls of families to get diagnosed more quickly, it just completely changes the game. For me, everything is about diagnosis, because once you're diagnosed, like I said, then you're able to line up your doctors, you're able to get the care and support that you need, you're able to understand really what's going on with your kid. You really just need to be diagnosed. And until the medical system changes enough where pediatricians are trained in this, it's going to fall on us parents to educate each other about genetic testing. And I hope that Rare Parenting helps us to get there. And for those kids without genetic disorders, for those kids with autism and ADHD and things that may not have a genetic component, I hope the website helps them also to care for their kids' symptoms. And I hope it provides them a community that they might not have had before.
It's very inspiring. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Anna. I hope you and your wife find it helpful.
Yes, thank you so much, Megan. I hope everyone's enjoyed hearing someone who's been faced with a problem, and she goes right after it, and she figures out a way to attack that problem. And I think it's just very inspirational, as Sonnet says. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation on Raising Rare. Please subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platform. We would love to get your feedback through ratings and reviews. And this week, tell someone that you think would be helped by our conversations on Raising Rare that they should be tuning in too.